Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is recorded at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 6th of February. The leader of a doomsday cult in Kenya is charged with mass murder, accused of persuading his followers to starve themselves to death. A year on from the devastating earthquake in Turkey, there are protests over the slow pace of reconstruction. And Spanish farmers join the Europe-wide protests. Also in the podcast, the British Prime Minister gives us an update on King Charles's cancer diagnosis.
Thankfully, this has been caught early, and now everyone will be wishing him that he gets the treatment that he needs and makes a full recovery.
And why Maori protesters are angry with the government in New Zealand. In April last year, a grisly story emerged from the Shakahola forest in eastern Kenya as police began investigating a remote cult led by the self-styled pastor Paul McKenzie. They found dozens of shallow graves and people who were starving. Eventually, they recovered 429 bodies. Autopsies revealed that most of the victims had died of hunger. Today, Mr. McKenzie and 29 suspected associates have gone on trial, charged with nearly 200 murders. Prosecutors say he ordered his followers to starve themselves and their children to death so they could go to heaven. Questions have been raised about how he evaded law enforcement despite facing previous charges. Our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy told me what happened in court.
The 191 counts of murder that the self-styled preacher Paul McKenzie and 29 of his associates have been charged with this morning. And he denied all charges. Previously, he's also been charged with committing acts of terror, child cruelty and torture. Already, he's serving a one-year sentence for producing and distributing films, that is, videos of his controversial sermons, without license. So a litany of charges there that have been levelled against him.
Yeah, and remind us how we've got to this day. He was, I think, first detained last year in April.
He was. He surrendered to police in April last year after reports emerged about children who were fasting to death, who were being starved, people as well. And as the reports got to the public, he surrendered to police. But previously, he was arrested in recent years again, and there were similar accusations, but he was released on a small bond. And that has led people to really complain about this. Now, last year, the government exhumed more than 400 bodies, most of them children, of followers of his church who had allegedly been starving to death. He denies these allegations. He says that he never asked anyone to fast to death.
And what kind of sentence could he face if found guilty?
If found guilty in Kenya, he would be sentenced to life in prison. And, you know, given the number of counts, depending on how many the prosecutor is able to prove, then it could be multiple life sentences.
And Soy in Kenya. A year ago today, Turkey and Syria were hit by a series of devastating earthquakes that left at least 56,000 people dead. Before dawn this morning, mourners in the ruined Turkish city of Antakya marked the moment when their lives changed forever and made clear their anger with the authorities. The Turkish health minister was loudly booed as he prepared to speak at one ceremony, while the region's mayor also faced an angry crowd. Despite promises from the Turkish president to rebuild, many are angry that millions remain homeless. Families are still living in tents with children going to makeshift schools. Our correspondent Anna Foster reported from Antakya a year ago and has been back to see the recovery effort.
Millions of lives changed forever on the night of the 6th of February, a year ago. Mohammed's was just one of them. Now 3 years old, he lost his parents, his home, and his right arm and leg.
Mostly, he crawls on his arm and leg. His struggle will grow with him when he sees people walking on their feet while he only has one, or using their arms while he can't.
That's Jamal Haider, a doctor who's been looking after Mohammed. The boy's parents, Hazar, a pharmacist, and Ahmad, who was an engineer, fled from Syria to Turkey to escape the war. When Mohammed was found 5 days after the earthquake, he was still wrapped in his father's arms. Dr. Haider says, despite his struggles, Mohammed is doing well.
There are some difficulties. Sometimes he gets angry and cries, then starts banging his head on the floor. But in general, he is a social kid. He behaves the same way anyone his age would. He sleeps and plays like any other child.
Mohammed has just one surviving relative, his aunt Manal, who was in Saudi Arabia when the quake happened. But local Turkish laws mean she struggled to take him out of the country or return herself to look after him. So he's being cared for by a succession of volunteers. The sound of heavy machinery still echoes around here. Even after a year of solid work, they still haven't managed to fully clear this place. It's flattened. There are just one or two buildings left standing, but too badly damaged for anybody to live in. You can see really starkly and clearly how the heart has been ripped out of this city of Antakya, and understand how it's so difficult for the survivors to imagine what their life is going to look like here now. Not far away, in northern Syria, a new camp was established for earthquake survivors whose lives were already bleak after being displaced by the war.
Our conditions in the tents are poor. In the winter, the rainwater enters the tents all the time. In the summer, it's extremely hot. The conditions are miserable. There aren't any roads or water.
The earthquake only added to Syria's problems. Save the Children says nearly 90% of the population there now needs aid, the highest level since the war began 13 years ago. In southern Turkey, finding somewhere to live is still one of the biggest problems. Tents and container villages that sprang up as temporary solutions now look far more permanent than was ever intended. Just under 50,000 new homes have been built so far. That's less than a quarter of what was promised. The Turkish government says the scale of the task has made it slow. But even a year after the earthquakes, there's still a long way to go to rebuild both homes and lives here.
Anna Foster in the Turkish city of Antakya. Father Tony O'Riordan from the Jesuit Refugee Service lives in the Syrian city of Aleppo and led the earthquake response there, helping about 1,000 families forced to leave their homes. He's been talking to Rob Young about the situation now.
So when the earthquake hit here just over a year ago, one of the significant impacts, apart from the collapsing buildings and the killing of thousands of people, was the impact on the psychological state of people, because the earthquake was citywide and it shattered the sense of safety. So this added to the compound state of people after the 12 years of the civil war. And it displaced thousands of people. Over 50,000 people had to leave their homes. The majority of those have now returned, but there are still a significant number of people whose shelter situation is very, very dire in the context of continuing deterioration of the life conditions of people here. Access to food, access to healthcare, access to income. All of these things have deteriorated. So the aid we have been delivering in response to the earthquake has been done on a treadmill of a worsening situation. So the people of Aleppo find themselves in a worse situation, I'm afraid, 1 year on. And in a context as well where the funds for humanitarian work is shrinking as the needs surge, the available resources, unfortunately, are shrinking.
So what is it like for people who've stayed in Aleppo? What is daily life like there?
It's a struggle, the struggle for survival, knowing whether they will have enough food today. Sometimes mothers are faced with, do they feed their children or do they get the needed medicine to heal them? Often denying themselves either food or medicine for themselves, wondering what tomorrow will bring. The mentality is that things continue to get worse. So people are under a lot of strain, and this is why our creation of safe spaces and psychological interventions are so important to try and maintain resilience and positive coping mechanisms. People are also living, of course, in the dark at nighttime because of the inadequacy of electricity. Most people live with 1 or 2 hours a day. So hunger, darkness, despair, these are the daily realities of thousands of people in Aleppo.
Father Tony O'Riordan in Syria. The Netherlands, France, Germany all have been hit by protests from angry farmers. Now, tractor disruption has reached Spain. The Spanish farmers have similar concerns to their counterparts across Europe, and they are warning that today's roadblocks are just the beginning.
We will block the road indefinitely and no truck will get through on any of the motorways until they pay attention to us, pay us what is due and make the red tape easier.
So how bad is the disruption in Spain? I asked our correspondent there, Guy Hedgeco.
Where I am, Oliver, in the town of Aranda de Duero, which is a couple of hours north of Madrid, it's been quite noticeable. There have been hundreds of tractors driving through the town. It's quite a small place, so it has disrupted the traffic a great deal here. That has varied in other parts of the country. Some places there has been a lot of disruption to people driving in their cars. Other places not so much. But it has been a protest which has been noticed across the country.
Yeah, when the farmers in France took action, they tried to blockade Paris for a couple of days. What's the plan for the farmers in Spain?
Well, what they're saying is they're going to continue doing these sort of protests in different parts of Spain, mainly the sort of farming heartland areas, such as where I am, which is sort of towards northern Spain. It's a major farming area here. They're going to keep doing that in this area and other areas over the next few days. And then later on in February, they say they're actually going to arrive in central Madrid, and they're going to go to the doors of the agriculture minister there to try and negotiate. So they say that unless things change a great deal, or the government can offer them something which really impresses them, they're going to push ahead with that plan.
Yeah, now we know farmers across Europe are unhappy at the moment. What are the specific complaints of the Spanish ones?
They believe that the European Union's farming regulations are too tight, that they constrict farmers and make it difficult for them to make a profit, and that pushes their costs up, and there's just simply too much red tape. So they're upset about that. But they also look to other countries that don't have to face that kind of bureaucracy outside the European Union. So, for example, they talk a lot about Morocco to the south. They say Morocco is not part of the European Union. It doesn't have to go through all these very strict environmental and sanitary controls that we have to. And yet its produce seems to come into Spain and other countries in the European Union without any problem. And therefore, they manage to undercut Spanish produce. So they want to see more controls for those sort of countries. The other thing they're upset about is the drought in Spain, which has been very serious in many parts of the country. And they want the government to take measures to try and alleviate the impact of the drought.
Guy Hedgeco talking to us from Spain. On this day in 1840, a treaty was signed in Waitangi in New Zealand to establish British governance while guaranteeing the rights of indigenous Maoris. But this year's official commemoration of Waitangi Day has been marked by protests. The demonstrators are angry that the new Conservative coalition in New Zealand wants to review the treaty as part of plans to undo policies protecting indigenous rights. Our correspondent Phil Mercer spoke to us from Sydney, starting with the significance of this agreement.
Well, it's the founding document of modern New Zealand. It guides the relationship between indigenous people, the Maori community, and the government. Now, protesters are accusing the country's centre-right governing coalition of wanting to degrade the Treaty of Waitangi, and hundreds of protesters have marched in opposition to proposed government policies at Waitangi It's a seaside community, and there have been commemorations and celebrations of the treaty signed in 1840, and also these large protests by hundreds of people. So certainly a very active day in that part of New Zealand.
Yeah, tell us about the disagreements. What is the government trying to do? What are the policies that it wants to undo?
Well, the centre-right government of the Prime Minister Christopher Luxon wants to bring in a bill to Parliament to reinterpret some of the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi and reassess how it's applied in an increasingly multicultural society. There is anger at the bill. Maori campaigners say it would be the most significant backward step for Indigenous rights in decades. There is a lot of politics at play here. The government says that it is supporting the introduction of the bill into the New Zealand Parliament by one of the junior coalition partners. But the government or the Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, doesn't believe that the bill will actually be passed. He says he just wants to generate a conversation about the future direction and interpretation of the Treaty of Waitangi. But safe to say, Maori campaigners in New Zealand believe that their fundamental rights are at stake here. We've seen weeks of protest, and we're likely to see many more in the future.
Phil Mercer. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
It's a fairly complete pterosaur. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a skull, but we do have most of the wings and quite a lot of legs and some of the vertebrae, the backbone.
The flying reptile that soared above the Isle of Skye.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student-athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
When he visited Saudi Arabia yesterday, America's top diplomat Antony Blinken spoke about efforts to, quote, achieve an enduring end to the conflict in Gaza. Today, the US Secretary of State is in Egypt before going on to Qatar and then Israel itself. So what can he do to bring an end to the war, even as Israel says it plans to target Rafah, despite the huge numbers of Palestinians who fled there to escape the fighting? And how can he secure the release of Israeli hostages still detained by Hamas? First, I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Nick Beek, what Mr. Blinken would be seeking from his meetings in Egypt.
Egypt has been really crucial in what's been happening, and notably in terms of getting aid into Gaza. Of course, Egypt to the south of Gaza. But also it's very important in what they're trying to do at the moment in finding the terms of a ceasefire. Egypt and also Qatar. And so that's why Secretary Blinken is going to those two countries, because they basically are the intermediaries between Hamas and Israel. We had these peace talks in Paris about 10 days ago now, and the outline of a deal was sort of thrashed out. And what's happened now is that this has been put to Hamas, and we're waiting for Hamas to come forward with what they think, basically, about this deal that has been put forward. So, yeah, Egypt really key today, so important discussions in Cairo.
Yeah, we're waiting for Hamas. There are reported to be divisions amongst the leadership there. Also, divisions in Israel itself. Tell us about those.
Yeah, there are. And particularly in Israel, these divisions are within the government here, and they've been played out very publicly. Specifically, you've got members of the government, right-wing ministers, who've said that they'll basically collapse the government. They'll walk away if they don't like a peace deal that is decided upon. And specifically what they're talking about is the idea that hundreds of Palestinian prisoners would be released from Israeli prisons at the same time that the hostages who were taken by Hamas on October the 7th are released from Gaza. They don't like that the right-wing members of the government here. But the thing is, this was the sort of the format, the framework that enabled the first wave of captives to be released back in November when there was some pause in the fighting, which enabled people to be freed. So we'll have to wait and see what's happening. All these conversations are taking place behind closed doors, so it's hard to assess at what point we're at the moment. But it may well be that there is very quickly movement. But certainly we're not getting any signs of any imminent breakthrough.
And Nick, looking at the broader region briefly, more attacks claimed by the Houthis in the Red Sea. It looks like the US and British deterrent doesn't appear to be working at the moment.
No, the Houthis say they'll continue to hit targets in the Red Sea. They say they're aiming for British, Israeli, American vessels in particular. And they say they're doing this in solidarity with the people of Gaza and that they won't let up until Israeli troops have withdrawn. We hear overnight that there's been an attack on another vessel. The Americans are saying that they are really trying to take out the capacity that the Houthis have to fire these missiles. But as we've seen, it seems they've got a long way to go before they completely eradicate that threat, Oliver.
Nick Beek in Jerusalem. King's cancer shock, just one of the headlines here in the UK this morning, as all the newspapers led on the news that Charles III had been diagnosed with the disease. Buckingham Palace didn't reveal which type of cancer the king has, other than to say it is not prostate cancer. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, gave his reaction to the BBC's Rachel Burden.
Well, obviously, like everyone else, you're shocked and sad, and just all our thoughts are with him and his family. And, you know, thankfully, this has been caught early, and now everyone will be wishing him that he gets the treatment that he needs and makes a full recovery. I think that's what we're all hoping and praying for, and I'm of course in regular contact with him, and we'll continue to communicate with him as normal.
Practically speaking, what does it mean for the day-to-day running of the country?
No, I think I'm in regular contact with the king, and that will of course continue as normal, and we'll crack on with everything. But he'll be in our thoughts and our prayers. Many families around the country who are listening to this will have been touched by the same thing, and they know what it means for everyone. So obviously we'll just be willing him on, and hopefully we can get through this as quickly as possible.
Have you spoken to him?
I'm in regular contact with him, and will continue to be so during this.
And does that mean your meetings face-to-face will continue, or will there be a different format?
We don't try to get into the details, but yeah. I'm in regular contact with him, as I always am, and that will absolutely continue.
Rishi Sunak. Our correspondent Charlotte Gallagher is outside Buckingham Palace. What did she make of the update from the British Prime Minister?
We hadn't been told that by the palace, that the cancer had been caught early. All we'd been told was that he'd been diagnosed with cancer. It had been found when he was being treated for an enlarged prostate. It wasn't prostate cancer, they said, but they didn't say what type of cancer it was or what kind of treatment he was having. We now know that it will be outpatient treatment, so he'll be going back and forth from hospital to his residence in London, just a few minutes' walk from Buckingham Palace, and he'll also be carrying out his constitutional work as head of state. So he'll still be reviewing documents, reviewing paperwork, signing parliamentary bills, and also still having his weekly meeting with the Prime Minister. So the behind-the-scenes work will still carry on, but of course we won't see him out and about doing public duties.
Yeah, you mentioned the King's enlarged prostate. The palace were quite open about that. Why are they not now revealing what cancer he has?
I think it's a privacy issue, really, Oliver. I mean, before, we probably, with previous senior members of the royal family, wouldn't have been told this much detail, that they'd been treated for cancer or they'd been treated for an enlarged prostate. This is very unusual to get this level of information from Buckingham Palace. Like all people, they're entitled to a level of privacy surrounding their health, and perhaps the palace didn't want constant speculation about what was wrong with the king. I think we can expect, perhaps, when his treatment is finished and he's feeling well enough, he'll probably talk more openly, perhaps, about what type of cancer he has had, given that when he talked about having an enlarged prostate, he said he did that to raise public awareness. So that's obviously something that's really important to him, making people aware of health conditions and also showing solidarity with other people being treated for cancer or prostate issues.
Meanwhile, the Prince of Wales returning to duties much earlier than planned after he was helping his wife with her recovery from abdominal surgery.
he is, Oliver, and perhaps Prince William would have been expecting a bit more time off from public duties. The Princess of Wales isn't going to be seen in public, we don't think, until after Easter, and they have three children, of course, to look after. But Prince William is essentially having to step up and carry out some of those public duties that would have been done by his father, the Queen as well, the King's wife, Queen Camilla. She'll be doing more public duties. Also, Prince Harry, he's on his way back to the UK, we think. He's been spotted, his car has been spotted at a Los Angeles airport, and we think he is coming back to see his father. They've not seen each other in person, we don't think, since the coronation almost a year ago.
Charlotte Gallagher at Buckingham Palace. The first global conference targeting so-called hackers for hire and spyware is taking place in Britain. 35 nations are expected to attend the event in London, along with companies involved in the sector. I heard more from our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
Spyware are tools to effectively hack into someone's mobile phone and turn it into a spy device, a surveillance device, collect information, switch on the microphones and so on. This has been developed by companies and often sold to governments, and governments are supposed to use it, if you like, for law enforcement or national security. But we've seen growing examples around the world, whether it's in the Middle East, Africa, Europe, Latin America, of it being used, for instance, to spy on activists, political opponents, dissidents and journalists. So that is a growing concern, that these tools, which are commercially available, are being used further and further afield and getting more and more advanced. Also, hackers for hire, if you like, are mercenary hackers who might be hired by one company to hack into another. So this is seen as a problem that's effectively growing. And this is an attempt to bring together different parties. So in London, you've got 35 countries. You've also got some of the big tech companies, but you've also got some of the companies which develop those tools, although we're not being told exactly the names of those companies. And the idea is to try and bring together some kind of oversight or framework to stop this really spiralling out of control.
So there might be, what, some kind of regulation?
Well, I think that's what's a bit unclear, because so far we've seen piecemeal steps by some countries. So interestingly, the US actually sanctioned and measures against one company, NSO Group, which had developed something called Pegasus, which was one of the best known of these spyware tools. So you've seen some countries take different actions, but I think the attempt is to try and come to some agreement about who should be able to use them and in what way. Now, whether we actually see concrete steps, I'm not sure. And I think it's an attempt to do something, but I think we'll have to watch very closely to see whether countries and companies are really able to agree on what the limits are for how this can be used. Because you can imagine that different countries will have different ideas of what are legitimate targets for them to go after. So I think it could be quite challenging.
Security correspondent Gordon Carrera. Scientists have identified a new species of giant flying reptile that lived at the same time as the dinosaurs. The fossil, found on the Scottish island of Skye in 2006, is a type of pterosaur that lived more than 160 million years ago. Most pterosaurs from this period were thought to have been in China. Dr. Liz Martin-Silverstone, a paleontologist at the University of Bristol, explained why it took so long to identify.
The area that it's found in on the Isle of Skye has very, very hard rock, and it was found on a boulder that had fallen down from the cliff face. And that boulder, first you had to remove it from the boulder, and then the rock itself, when it was first found, you could only see one or two bones on the surface after spending many, many hours getting it down to the point where we could see more like 10 or 15 bones on the surface. Then I actually put it into a CT scanner and we were able to find more things within the rock from that as well. The fossil itself is still within the rock because it's so fragile, we actually can't remove it. So everything is still in the block itself. It's a fairly complete pterosaur. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a skull, but we do have most of the wings and quite a lot of legs and some of the vertebrae, the backbone. And with that, comparing it to other pterosaurs, we could see it had sort of unique features that other pterosaurs didn't have. So that's how we knew that it was a new species. We agreed on the name, trying to come up with something that could sort of honor its Scottish background. So it's called Cheoptera, Cheoptera evansae. So Cheoptera comes from Elena Keo, which is the name, the Gaelic name for the Isle of Skye. And then evansae honors Professor Susan Evans, who is a paleontologist who's worked in that area quite significantly, and actually the person who told us to go and look there in the first place. So we wouldn't have found it if it weren't for her. She's quite chuffed. She's pretty happy. We've given her some of the artwork from it, and she's quite happy to have, you know, been involved in it as well.
Paleontologist Liz Martin-Silverstone. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham and produced by Tracy Gordon. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.